Howard Lindzen is the founder and general partner at Social Leverage. All opinions expressed by Howard and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Social Leverage or StockTwits. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. Guests may maintain positions and securities discussed in this podcast.
Somebody got a new computer.
You did.
You did it.
I did it.
Wow. Is it Apple?
It is an Apple. It is a...
You're an original Mac guy as a marketing person.
This is an Apple on serious...
And I told you to get one months ago. What is it? Is it helping us? Is our sound better?
It's on serious steroids.
Is our numbers going to go up?
Oh yeah.
Ooh, oh, yeah. Kanye Jensen. That's your new name. I have a feeling Kanye is going to be president. That's just my feeling. And by the way, Canute. I'm trying to put Kanye and Canute together. How would I do that better?
Canuto.
Canute, yay.
That's the Spanish version of it.
Anyways, you're my president, Canute. And today, Lewis Johnson runs an asset management firm, an RIA, in Florida.
All right.
I've gone fishing with him. I've checked out the operation. Lewis knows his stuff. Cool. And he said it's about $2 billion. I don't know the exact number, but has been a money manager, stock picker, research analyst from T. Rowe Price on. So I love talking about stocks, and I rarely do that on this show. But I just felt it's time to check in and get some serious sage advice about asset management. I get so many calls every day. Let's talk about stocks, Howard. Let's not just talk to entrepreneurs and traders. So I pinged Lewis, who has been doing this forever. And I said, "Let's. Do you mind doing this?"
And it's great.
Just like, let's do it.
I want to know one thing though. Oh, did you catch any fish on the trip?
We did. We didn't. We went tarpon fishing.
Nice.
And we did not catch tarpon. Tarpon fishing is not like a guaranteed thing.
That is. I've seen them underwater scuba diving. They're fantastic.
Yeah, fantastic. And we had a grand old time. Caught a bunch of redfish, and we did not go empty-handed. But that's what it's called, fishing, not catching. And no one likes, I don't look like a fisherman. We just look, it would size me up. I go, Howard's not going fishing. But guess what? I'm Lewis Lattesa. I'm not horrible. I didn't hook him in the eye on any of my casts. And then we cooked up some of the fish at his club, at his yacht club. So let's get Lewis on the phone.
Will do.
Hey, Howard.
Lewis.
Good afternoon, Howard.
That accent, that's very Manhattan, isn't it?
I get that a lot,
Yeah, that a lot. When I was Brooklyn or Upper East?
Yeah, when I was at Wharton, I remember there was a girl in my classmate, and she said, "Oh my God, you sound just like Bill Clinton when you talk."
Was it hard to get into Wharton back in the, when you were 60, 70 years ago? I'm just guessing.
Yeah,
about
a million years ago when the earth was young and dinosaurs roamed.
When dinosaurs roamed, did they a little bit? I'm being a little bit.
Well, I was all over the Southern textile lobbyist angle, right? Which, as everybody knows, is the power way to get into Wharton. And I rode that to glory as a textile lobbyist coming from North Carolina.
When did you wake up and go, I got to go to Wharton, Dad? Is that a moment, or is that just like you were just a geek and like wanted to be a banker?
I had been in the textile industry as a lobbyist for the first 6 years of my career, and it was a lot of fun, Howard. Because I was working in D.C. and I was working on international trade legislation, working with congressmen and senators and this kind of stuff, and it was a lot of fun. It's a very heady thing for like a young person, but
right.
But one of the things that I figured out during that time is that I had to represent the industry overseas, which meant I had to be able to suggest to the government like the right course of action. And so I started studying the companies and the industry. And then what was interesting to me was I would get calls from, let's say the textile experts, whose responsibility as sell side research analysts were to follow these companies. And they would just ask me the stupidest questions. And I remember thinking, well, like if these guys are the experts and they don't know what they're talking about, then maybe this investing thing, maybe there's money in that, And so I talked to a number of people about, how to make that transition, and there's not much of a market for stock picking lobbyists. So the counsel I got from people I trust was that, you need to get one of those name brand MBAs up north. And so that's what I did. I sold out to the man.
And
it was very uncreative.
But the man's been pretty good to you.
The man has been good to me. Yeah, and the money I spent at Wharton was very well spent.
And would you do, well, today, let's go to today. Lewis Johnson, tell people what you do.
Well, sure. Well, there's a number of, you know, companies in which, you know, I'm active. I founded an alternative investment management company called Fundamental Global with Kyle Sermonera and Joe Moglia back in 2012. And one of the first things that we figured out is that, you know, Kyle and I were good at managing money, but turning an alternative investment management company into a business required a kind of different skill set. So we were fortunate enough to be introduced to some family friends, two gentlemen who had co-founded an estate planning company down here in Naples, where you're reaching me, called Capital Wealth Advisors. A guy named Bill Bynum and Blaine Ferguson have been childhood friends, and they did a great job in terms of estate planning and working with wealthy clients, but they didn't understand like one of the better parts of that business, which is the annuitized, you know, revenue stream that can come from working with clients in a wealth management platform. And so we thought, hey, well, you know, Kyle and I can manage money, and you guys, you know how to, you know, help acquire customers. Maybe this will work, you know. And that business thankfully blossomed, and I don't know, I forget where the last AUM is, but 1.6, 1.7 billion, something like that, over the last, I guess, 7 years.
So you're a startup. Like, what people don't understand about this business.
We bootstrapped it. Yeah. My personal balance sheet will demonstrate that we bootstrapped it.
I mean, that's one of the great things that people don't understand about the money business. It's before the internet, managing money was being an entrepreneur. And today it's kind of hard because the margins are so slim, and the marketing, this passive investing monster is something that you're marketing against, correct?
You know, that's true, Howard. I mean, I think I felt those forces a little bit more poignantly when I was, you know, at T. Rowe, you know, because as a big established institutional, you know, manager, it's hard to not look like, say, the market. And then there's the expenses that go on that. And of course, passive has really been on an amazing tear. But you know, one of the things that I've discovered in the wealth management side of the business, you know, Howard, is many of the people whose money we manage, they're entrepreneurs. And so these people took a couple of big risks in life to create something, and now they're in a point in mind where they don't want it to go away. And so one of the things that we do is you may have seen from kind of following how we try to do things a little differently, is we really try to educate people and let them follow along with their thinking. So we have research publications, you know, we have periodic conference calls and webcasts and stuff with clients, because we're the ones making the investment decision. And so what we often do, Howard, is we have a strong quality bias. We have a big framework in terms of risk management first. And what we found is that a number of our clients really respond to that because they took a lot of risks early, and what they want to do is know that they're working with smart people who are going to thoughtfully take care of their money.
And so are you're classically trained then Wharton, then T. Rowe. You were at T. Rowe mm-hmm. a long time.
Yeah, like six years. That's where we met our common friend. A little shout out to Lowell Kamen. Goes back a million years.
Lowell and I went to kindergarten together. We made Kraft macaroni and cheese and hot dogs. And next thing you know, I'm fishing in Florida.
Yeah, you said you guys made hot dogs together or something. Yeah.
We made hot dogs together. We probably fought a lot because that's what kids do. Jewish kids at that age are just turf war. And my dad's a lawyer, dad's an accountant type thing, you know. Tough Jewish mm-hmm. guys. And, you know, flash forward, I don't know, 50 years I've been friends with him in and out. He's New York, Toronto. And he's like, you got to meet Lewis. And I said, like, of course, I'd love to meet Lewis. Next thing you know, you and I are fishing, and fuck Lowell. He's written out of history. Other than the shout
out. I don't even remember what that guy's name was. Yeah.
So, and what was it that finally said, I'm going to ready to make the jump? Was it the intro knowing that, okay, I know how to manage money? Was the key thing having the customer acquisition part? Because that's no different than a startup, right? You've got to figure out product market fit. You had product fit around...
You mean the whole entrepreneurial angle, kind of deciding to do that?
Yeah, that's a big move.
Well, you know, I think, Howard, I was like the accidental entrepreneur doing this out of desperation, because I worked for a lot of very smart people and learned a ton. And I'm grateful to all those people that, you know, really helped me kind of along the way understand their framework, and that helped shape mine. But you know, along the way, after doing that for other people for 10 years at kind of a higher level, you develop an idea that says, you know, like, I think I know a better way to do this, or at least I think I know there's a great way to do this that I'm capable of. And if I can just do it in that way, right, then I'm going to be... I believe I could be super successful, you know, and so maybe in you know, prior lives, prior careers, work with people, maybe it was 98% there and 2% off or whatever, but it just felt like just that little bit off was very vexing. And so my decision to kind of, you know, throw my hat in the entrepreneur ring and you know, be cash poor and business rich for a long time and kind of risk everything. Really had to do with the fact that I just felt like I could be successful if I could do it in the way that I wanted to. And nobody else would let me do it that way. And so I had to do it myself. I had to, you know, nobody did it that way. We had to create it ourselves, which is what we did.
And so tell me a little bit about how the shop works, the two of them, Fundamental Global and the asset management firm.
Yeah, well, sure. So of course, you know, Fundamental Global is a diversified, you know, alternatives manager. So we have a, you know, a whole host of kind of niche-based products where the idea is that we're really trying to put points on the board performance-wise. And then that's a very different goal than if you think of what we're trying to do at Capital Wealth Advisors, right? Because at Capital Wealth Advisors, as I described, you know, Howard, we're still doing, you know, fundamental research, classic, you know, stock picking investment. You know, but there's a broader palette in terms of asset allocation, you know, and you're trying to manage money thoughtfully for people. So you're trying to, you know, invest for the long run. And, you know, and so it's a bit of a different framework. And so the way I kind of think about it is it's all investment research, but it goes kind of in different buckets. And so there's a little bit of a different methodology, but it's much more about, you know, really, I think managing for, you know, the long run at the wealth management side of what we do. And that's a very relationship intensive business. And frankly, that's kind of exactly what I wanted, because I guess the view of the firm that I envisioned, Howard, that would be very successful was that, but because the best investment, in my opinion, takes a long time, if you don't have a relationship with a client to be able to sit down, you know, at their dining room table or in the office and say, hey, look, you know, we're underperforming now because, you know, we see a turn coming and we're early for that because best values, but this is what we think is going to happen. And this is why we're doing something that seems paradoxical. And I really felt like if we had that tool that we could do a better job for clients in terms of managing for the long run. And I haven't been disappointed in terms of, I feel like that relationship part's really delivered.
Yeah. As I turn 55 and every Zoom call and podcast could be my last and Knut knows this, he just has seen the aging. It's like Biden at this point, you know, I'm picking a successor. And so see, if this was my last podcast, I wanted to be clear that I love the business. This is why I flew out to see you, and I'm fascinated by this business because it's I can't think of a better business in terms of if you're good at what you do and positioning yourself for a generational business is the business of investing. So now that you have the craft, and I think what's genius about what you did, Frank, because I've been wanting to be involved, is, and why I set up my own RIA with Charlie, is I think you have to have both. Like, I got to understand the conflicts, but I think you have to be able to do the asset management, build the trust, and do the relationships. But on the other side, alpha is really important. In a world of 0% interest rates, I'm more interested in the fundamental global side. And I'm actually in business with you randomly through a SPAC. But, like, so tell me how you knew to set up both, because you're kind of ahead of the curve on that. And how do you keep church and state separate there? And I know there's no conflict, but there's always no conflict, no interest, but there is potential. How do you separate the two?
Mm-hmm. Well, I definitely agree, Howard, that I think, well, look, we've got a great team. And I think there's a lot of people that have participated in the success of kind of our common endeavors. And I think one of the reasons that it's worked, like you said, is that it's, you know, it's real research, and that's why we communicate so much. You know, because I mean, we maybe we're wrong, right? We actually think we know what we're doing, and so we're happy to talk to people in real time about, you know, what we're doing. You know, about why we see an opportunity in a certain security, or why we see an opportunity in the bond market, or why we might see an opportunity in the commodity market. You know, and you know, and what my experience has been, Howard, is that if you talk to people like adults. You know, because it is their money, right? And they have the right to ask questions. I mean, they respect that, you know, and God knows we haven't gotten everything right. And, you know, we're early more often than, you know, than not. But what I've found is that, you know, if you can communicate that message with humility, you know, what you don't know, people respond.
Yeah. And the fundamental global side. So how do you decide what is an opportunity outside of just asset allocation? Because I that's the part that fascinates me, because I believe the alpha's on the street, as I always say, and in your eyes and in your ears, and in passive investing, and the fact that they've taken fees down to zero and chopped up the world, and rates are at zero. I think the fundamental global side is like so interesting to me. So how do you, when did you decide to start that, or was it at the same time?
I've known my partners are with whom I co-founded that back in 2012. Kyle Sermonair and I were fellow analysts at T. Rowe Price, right. And we collaborated quite a bit beginning from 2001 on. Mm-hmm. And I think we both respected the work that we were doing. And even though we worked for different firms after that, we kind of had a successful and profitable run through the global financial crisis. And I don't think there were a lot of people that could say that. And I remember thinking, well, hey, this worked really well. Maybe there's the basis for some kind of future collaboration. And, you know, we kept in touch. And then we talked about, the fact that we had that shared goal that we thought there was a kind of a better way to do investment management. So that part kind of came together first. You know, we started talking about that in early 2012. I think we launched our first partnership in kind of late 2012. But one of the things that we do is we were talking to kind of the usual suspects, endowments and institutional managers, this kind of stuff. And what we found is that we felt like we had, demonstrated to people that knew us that we really knew what was going on, but it was a harder slog on the bigger ticket institutional side. And so I think the view that we had was like, hey, look, if we built this relationship by relationship in terms of working with high net worth individuals, that could be, the kind of the golden ticket, for lack of a better word, right? Because what that would mean would be that we would be kind of creating our new kind of common track record as we were going forward. And then we felt like the track record could be good if we could communicate with clients, right? And if we could help them focus on the long run, all the things that have made us successful in the past. And I think the business kind of delivered on that.
And what was your favorite time at T. Rowe Price? What was like the one thing that was just magical? Like one trend, I know you've told me, but like, let's go through like a major trend.
Well, there's a couple things I think I was really proud of. I mean, we were able to identify, a big cyclical turn in the commodity cycle, kind of in 2002 and 2003. And so we studied that exhaustively for, a year or two, back when nobody really cared. Like I used to joke that, you could like the higher for longer group of commodity bulls, we could hold those meetings in a phone booth in 2003. Mm-hmm. It was like me and Jim Rogers, Barry Bannister, I think maybe Jim Lennon, who worked for Macquarie in London. I think those were the four of us. I had the temerity to put a lot of money into a couple beaten down sectors, particularly the steel sector and the fertilizer sector. We put some big dollars to work and had, just really great returns for shareholders. I was really proud of that.
And so today, now that people know who you are, I want to talk about the markets a little bit and how you think the top down or bottom up of the world. We're heading into 2021. Rates are pretty much zero. Everybody's fighting about, what the market going to do based on who's in charge. So what is on page 10, because you're managing real money and talking to clients every day. Is there anything on page 10 that's like, we have to be careful of this? It's not, no one's talking about it. But what don't we know that keeps you up at night?
That's a good question, Howard. I really do think, it's taken a long time, but, I guess one of the ways my framework is different is that I really, live for and seek out kind of cyclical change. And, and tech has had this big, powerful run for so long, I think I can see the outline of what's going to end that, and whether that's in now or 6 months or I don't know, 2 years or something. I don't have any visibility of that. But, if you go back and you study the other big tech runs, there's at least two, right? There was, of course, a 99-2000 tech run, and that was followed, of course, by the commodity cycle, really, right? Mm-hmm. Because what had happened is when tech blew up, the Fed really stepped in, got aggressive. It sounds familiar, mm-hmm. And that created kind of a loose money situation. And frankly, gold and other commodities had been really kind of pounded by the strong dollar, strong financial return markets. In many ways, they are kind of opposites. And so you had a good, 7 to 11 year, commodity upcycle. But if you take a look at how powerful like this big tech cycle has been, you could argue that it's kind of analogous. I mean, I don't see another China coming on. Frankly, the industrialization of China, which is kind of what I kind of blundered into with my value position, the commodity cycle in 2002 and 2003, that was a once every 500 year cycle, right? So that was extraordinary. But there's another example of tech and kind of what comes after that. Howard, that's kind of the Nifty 50 peak. Mm-hmm. That kind of blew out. I think it was about 72 or so. And you remember that was the one decision stocks. You know, this was kind of like 3M, Polaroid, whatever. You had growth companies that traded at just enormous valuations. And of course, what really undid that, honestly, was when Nixon in August of 1971 took the dollar off the gold standard. And so the gold
price
went up a lot.
Did no one see that coming? I don't. I wasn't old enough to care, and I still don't care in many ways. But now, as a historian, I have to care.
Well, if you were watching the gold market, and you—I mean, of course, it came out of the blue because all the nasty macroeconomic things happened on the weekend. Howard, that's a pro tip. So this happened like, you know, Saturday. It was like a Saturday night, Sunday night kind of thing, mm-hmm. and that really marked like a change in the currency system. Remember, because one ounce of gold had basically been fixed at like $35 an ounce since like 1935.
No, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. So it was a change in the existing order. Things had been one way for 36 years. And then what happened is the dollar devalued pretty meaningfully, right? So it went from needing $35 to buy 1 ounce of gold to $860 to buy 1 ounce of gold. So gold went up like 25-fold.
Whoa.
Which is the same. Yeah, which is a huge bull market, right? Mm-hmm. And so that drug a lot of other commodities with it. But here's the point that I'm making, Howard, in terms of, you know, like to your question, maybe what's on page 10 or something, mm-hmm. is that... you know, I think that there's a pretty well-defined pattern of kind of two polar opposites, both that cause things, right? And, reasonable people can disagree about politics and everything, but I think people understand that it's very divisive right now and that it's very corrosive and that, you know, it's very rare that we've seen a combination that's kind of this toxic. People are just profoundly unhappy.
Yes.
And of course, if you take a look at the growth, the great analyst Lacey Hunt, who writes at Hoisington, is a brilliant bond guy. Lacey has made the point that that we just had the slowest decade of growth. 2010, 2020 was the slowest decade in growth in the U.S. since 1790, since the founding of the Republic.
Wow.
So I understand why people are angry. And so so one way or another, what I have come to believe, Howard, is that when you have an economic situation that is causing this much angst or whatever, there will be a political release that will drive it kind of the other way to try to address that. And so part of that happened. And when that happened in the 70s, it killed the Nifty 50. Mm-hmm. And when that happened after it wasn't this kind of populist thing that was driving it, but kind of when tech, you know, flamed out and when commodities had such a poor growth record, and it's not just commodities, it's the whole value framework of the market, right? I saw something today that said this has been the worst stretch of value stocks versus growth stocks in the last 200 years. Wow. So that's a very anomalous event. And now, it could overshoot some more, so this is not a prediction in the short run or whatever, Howard. But it's been my experience as a cyclical investor that the market is brutal in this one way is it will reward you for being an expert in something narrow, and then all of a sudden it will make your knowledge irrelevant because something 10,000 miles away in the other end of the world will start working. You don't know anything about it, right?
Yeah.
And so that's the humbling nature of the market. And so I really think that at some point you look at the market caps, you look at what's taken place in tech, which has just been literally like one of the most powerful cycles in the world. And it just doesn't make sense that on this set of politics and with people this angry, with growth this low, that's an equilibrium situation. I just don't see that can last.
Okay, now that, Canute, what do you think? Profound. You don't like chiming in, but I was waiting for. I should have led with that question. Can we make that first? Cares what Lewis does for a living. That was good shit, man. That's why I went fishing.
That's not bullshit, Howard.
It's not bullshit. Listen, I'm the guy who's one foot out the door as a Canadian who's enjoyed this. I'm captain of the narrow squad. You know, I've got a narrow nose, narrow head, narrow feet. I'm narrow. And there's never been a better time to be narrow. And I know that narrow is not going to last, you know. And I have no new tricks. I'm 55 years old. So I have one foot out the door. I'm like, I get it. Zoom. I get zero interest rate, pay for growth. I mean, I'm not going to fight that. But I know the other side of this mountain, no pun intended to the movie, but the other side of this mountain is so messy, so much unwinding. And that's what I worry about. I know that cyclically, you know, no matter what they drugs they give this market, that rates at zero, money printing. Come on, how much do you have to understand? And we got crypto out there, and we've got SPACs, and we've got direct listings, and there's all these avenues being built to slowly try and release. You know, everybody's trying their best to come up with shit to keep this party going. But you know, I just want people to know that like it just can't last.
Well, you know, look, these things have a way of lasting longer than you think. Because again, I remember my young self at Wharton, like in '98, talking to my classmates, and as the TMT bubble was raging, and I remember telling these people, like, "Oh, you're going to choke on your own blood," you know,
pre-Twitter, you would just yell out the window, "Hey, everybody, you're gonna choke on your own blood."
Yeah, six months later, you know, and maybe people, you know, maybe a few people listened, you know, maybe swore it off, and then 6 months later, they were like, whatever happened to that, you know? And then a year later it was a joke. And then by 2 years, you know, I mean, I was like a laughingstock, right? Because, you know, it's just that's what happens in, you know, in the markets, you know, timing is brutal, you know, but you asked the right question, Howard, which really is kind of that, it's kind of like the next thing. I mean, the next thing could be starting now. The next thing could be starting in 6 weeks. The next thing could start in 2 years or something, you know, but that's been my experience, is that cycles are powerful and unexpected, and they move from kind of opposite to opposite. And so I don't know. So it doesn't have to unfold like it did last time. Because like I said, I don't sit here and tell you, Howard, that I mean, you know, the industrialization of China was the biggest deal in 500 years.
Hindsight. Yeah.
But here's the point though, Howard. And I don't know if I were just going to leave, you know, like your listeners with just kind of one like, at least profound fundamental point that I used to kind of make sense of commodity markets after spending 20 years, you know, in them or whatever, is that it's that the gold price is a leading indicator for all commodities because it represents the value of kind of all currencies. And so when the gold price doubles, what that really reflects is the value of the dollar or whatever currency you're looking at has actually fallen by half. Mm-hmm. And if you remember your microeconomics class, Micro 101, right? The long run commodity price is where that ends up residing is where the price is equal to the marginal cost of production. So if the gold price doubles, and it has doubled in the last 4 or 5 years, it means that the kind of long run commodity prices are facing upward price pressure, maybe not necessarily a double. But if you take a look across the commodity complex, corn's on the move, wheat's on the move, lumber kind of doubled or tripled, you know, things are moving in an economy that's not that great. And so if you had understood that in the 70s, Howard, then, you know, your decade was made for you. So even though it was a challenging time for many people to be in the capital markets, you know, you knew one big thing. And if you knew one big thing, you knew enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, the one big thing here is to keep your eyes open. So how do you keep your eyes open for the average person at home that is smaller and doesn't have a wealth manager? What, and they're what, like, how do you stay ahead of the one big thing? What do you look for a turn? Obviously, Saturday night policy changes. I mean, there's enough smart people on social media that you should trust that you can follow and say, whoops, that's a big change. So is there anything that you follow to just try and, you know, I know you're going to be early, but is there stuff that you can track, or is it just the price of gold, or is it like interest rates?
Well, you know, that's a really good question, Howard. I mean, I think the way I've tried to think about things is that, you know, things happen for, you know, for a reason. You know, there's no kind of price fairy, right? Price has a role in the commodity world. Like the price is the traffic cop that balances supply and demand, right? So when the price goes up, the traffic cop is saying, I'd like more production, please, because I'm going to let you make all of this money, right? But when the price goes down, the traffic cop is saying, please stop making production. You're making too much, and I'm going to punish you, and, you know, with these horrible low prices until you stop making as much. And so price is not it's not some extraneous variable. It's an actual causal factor. And so we think a lot about why things have to happen, and we think a lot about supply and demand. We think a lot about what the role of price is, what price has to do to meet certain, you know, future outcomes. And you know, and so what I hope we've developed, Howard, is kind of a causal framework where I want to be intellectually flexible enough where I could run a completely contrary set of data through that framework and I would have a completely different view. But the framework doesn't change. The data changes. And so so one of the things, I guess, I don't know if I'd say I'm proud of or whatever, but you know, I've there have been instances in the past when, you know, I was like super bullish on something on Friday, and on Monday I was bearish because the data changed. And, you know, investing can be very humbling and very punishing, you know. And so what you really want to do is develop that framework that if the data turns, you can turn on a dime. And that's very difficult to do. It takes a lot of discipline. And I can't say I've achieved it, but I know the importance of it.
And so I'll end up with a couple other esoteric questions. Crypto, does the firm, I know you have an open mind, so where are you around decentralization and how it fits in with commodities?
I can't say as I understand it, you know, Howard, so I don't really have an investment opinion on it. We're not active in it. But I mean, I think I get the concept of kind of digital gold, and I get the concept of almost like that libertarian seeking out of things that are, I don't know, what's the right word for it? But, you know, but that they're kind of unencumbered, you know, that are stateless, you know, that kind of exist outside the constructs of the government moving everybody's cheese. So I understand that. You know, I don't know really how to value it, you know, and frankly, you know, investing, and this is a lesson that people will learn in the next bear market, is that valuation does matter. That never matters in the bull market, but it matters in the bear market. So because I'm incapable of valuing it, I've just watched it from the sidelines. So I'm not bullish or bearish. I'm just,
It's a true mood ring. And then where with creative financing, we came together on one project, but where are you, and I think this goes under Fundamental Global, in the SPAC world, we're hearing SPAC, SPAC, SPAC. I joke about it all the time. I'm SPAC Lindsay. Mm-hmm. So what's your take on how that, why it came back and how serious is it? And is it interest rate driven or is it people driven? What's your best take?
Well, I mean, maybe it's just as simple as innovation, Howard. You know, I mean, if there's one thing that we've all learned in the financial services world, right, it's the relentless push of disintermediation. It's the relentless push of fee compression. And I think I see those forces at work in terms of, say, SPACs versus, you know, traditional investment banking and things like that. You know, and I also think that, you know, SPACs have the ability, and we've got a great team. I couldn't be more proud of our team. I mean, just super people with amazing skill sets in the vertical, as well as amazing skill sets in actually the nuts and bolts of running these things. And you know, I just feel like it's a great team that I know is out there working hard. But I think it really is part of this bigger trend, Howard, of disintermediation in the financial sector, you know, and the push for innovation.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me how something that's been around so long, and there's all these little things that went off, all these little, it's kind of like the gold Nixon thing. It was like, was it SoftBank that finally tipped it? Was it, you know, am I getting enough value from Fidelity, T. Rowe, SoftBank in a Series F versus, you know what I mean? Like, what was it? There was a Saturday night. I think WeWork was the Saturday night. Like, I mean, if WeWork had SPAC, the world would look a lot different, right?
Oh, no, that's
interesting. There'd be a lot of SPAC juice on people. And, you know, maybe we wouldn't even, they would have wrecked SPACs before it started. And in fact, it only just wrecked SoftBank's reputation at many levels and allowed SPACs to just say, fuck it, if those idiots can do it, we can do it. That's my take. Mm. But you're just saying it's just plain and simple, just innovation and timing was right and fee compression, which I agree with too. But I think the Nixon moment was kind of SoftBank, where like it would have been ugly if they were public, and luckily they weren't. And, you know, the public didn't have to eat the whole thing yet. And it allowed this innovation to take off, you know? And so I think it's just an interesting moment. And it's random that that's how we came back together around on something like this. So I feel like there's karma in all this stuff too. One trend that you were ahead of is education. So where's, you know, you've been homeschooling, you and your wife. Mm-hmm. So what triggered that? Because you were way ahead of the curve there.
Well, really, you know, it was not a political statement or anything like that. You know, Howard, we were up in Westport, you know, Connecticut, in the hedge fund ghetto. And
yeah, that damn, you know, low tax area.
In the ghetto. But we escaped the hedge fund ghetto. But back when I was a prisoner in the hedge fund ghetto, one of the things that, you know, there's amazing resources up there. And we had our kids in private schools and we were really happy with them. And then we felt like, well, we could do this better. And so what if we, you know, and so we basically kind of chartered a small offshoot for a school that our kids were attending. And we hired a couple of great specialists. We custom designed the curriculum. And I remember thinking, well, this is going to be wonderful. right? This is going to be like the best of the best, you know, Yale PhD and all this, you know, specialized educational background. And it was close, but it just didn't kind of work, you know? And at that point, I think we got to a place of frustration because we kind of felt like, we kind of went to the nth degree, you know, in the quote unquote traditional system or whatever, and we didn't get what we wanted. And so my wife, you know, Carol, she's a wonderful patient human being. And she kind of looked at this and always had a sense of mission to say, well, you know, who loves your kids better than you do, you know? And that part of education is you really, you know, caring for your kids and being with them and helping them kind of take the world apart and understand it and ask, you know, really good questions. And so she had a sense of mission about that. And you know, we felt like doing it because we just felt like we had pursued everything we could kind of traditionally. So apparently we were 10 years ahead, you know, of the trend or whatever. But, it's not for everybody, but it can have a really good result for people who are committed to it.
And silver linings of this COVID thing, you're home, the kids, you know, are different ages. And is there any silver linings that you've seen?
In terms of personal, Howard, or
both personal RIA business? I mean, it's been a lot.
The CWA has absolutely blossomed in the last quarter or two. We've got great people. And frankly, it's been blossoming for a long time. But maybe part of that was the markets were very uncertain, Howard. I guess you started this whole podcast right when things were going crazy, right? And mm-hmm. And so we launched a pretty aggressive customer outreach effort. And so we were doing a conference call, kind of like a WebEx thing, like once a week, right? And we were talking about things we were seeing in the market and kind of how steps we were taking within the portfolio. And I think, you know, and it was us trying to share what we thought was real analysis in terms of what we really cared and were seeing and how we were addressing things. And I think people responded to that. So who knows? I mean, I've heard people say broadly, Howard, and I don't know if you would agree with this, that you know, perhaps the all the many changes, many of them dark, frankly, with this whole COVID crisis really kind of packed, you know, 8 or 10 years of innovation or acceleration of trends into, you know, a 6-week period.
Yeah, amazing time. So I really appreciate your time here. We'll have to make this a regular thing. I know you're busy. And how do people, for the freebies, and obviously you have your firm, so people, what's the easiest way to find you to just chat with you?
I publish a modest kind of research publication called Trends and Tail Risks. That's published on the Capital Wealth Advisors website. People can follow that. I have an extremely modest presence on Twitter and, of course, the obligatory LinkedIn, you know, where really I'm just kind of passing along some of our research pieces. And it's modest, Howard, because I think often of something that you said while we were fishing that I never forgot. You said,
Can I pee over the side?
That's you're not on. You said you're on social media all the time or never.
Yeah, you can't. There's no in between.
Yeah. And so I'm pretty much never on.
I like that.
I'm pretty much never on, but you know, but we're always thinking, and I'll tell you, it's great though. One of the great things about publishing, Howard, is, you put your investment views out there, you put your framework out there. And I've had, you know, a handful of people that I never would have found in a million years, you know, reach out or find what I was writing, you know, interesting or provocative. And I've struck up some great relationships with extremely thoughtful people that I never would have found if I wasn't publishing regularly and kind of putting out, you know, putting the thoughts out there. So it's been a great investment.
Yeah, it's a sin. 2020, it's a sin if you're not putting your thoughts out there. Who cares who reads them? But it's a miracle. You'd be surprised what happens. You know, it's like fishing.
Yeah, I totally
agree. Like fishing, man. If your line's not in the water, how are you going to catch a fish?
Well, that's true, Howard. You know,
unless you have bombs.
And as a fisherman, you would know, right? You know, the number one determinant for successful fishing is time on the water.
And what would surprise you most about, you know, then you met me and I threw a line. Were you surprised that I caught a fish? Were you surprised I knew what I was doing?
No, you knew what you were doing. You were clearly a player.
Ha! You hear that, Knut?
Ha. I heard that.
Yeah. We didn't catch a tarpon, but a tarpon didn't catch me. So,
we need to come back next time and do that.
Man,
you know,
I'm a big fan.
The cold fronts have blown through. So actually, it's probably not going to be until maybe next May or a couple of days that warm up in February. The tarpon may be out, but otherwise, it's going to be kind of slim pickings.
And so, in the winter like this, when it's like that, what can you expect? Or do you just put up the bone sail, wait until May?
No, the fishing becomes different. you know, Howard, like the Spanish mackerel are still kind of running in there. So I went out a couple weeks ago and really got into them. The sea trout, speckled sea trout, are about to kind of come on strong during the winter, and that's a great eating fish. So there's pretty much always something going on, but it's beautiful to be on the water then. But frankly, the best tarpon fishing really is in the heat, you know, in August down in the 10,000 islands right north of the Everglades. It's punishing.
It's no different than going to Cabo to, you know, you got to go in the heat to catch the marlin.
Yeah.
And then Florida, what's your take? Like you're there. I kind of like it. It's far for me in Arizona or California. It's not convenient, Florida, Cali, for whatever reason. You can get anywhere and go to New York. So where's Florida fit in, you know, in this tax world that's potential? Like, how are you bullish on Florida?
I tell you, I love Florida. I don't know why everybody doesn't live in Florida.
Well, they started to.
Yeah. I mean, well, look, I mean, I've been here for 7 years and, you know, most people are from kind of somewhere else or whatever, but the weather's, you know, like for instance, the weather was, it was 60 degrees this morning and I think it got as high as about 75. So it's absolutely beautiful. You know, and it'll stay that way consistently through April. So the winters are wonderful and summers are hot, but frankly, the fishing is great. You know, I love the beach, you know, I mean, I've kind of been all over the place and I always wanted to have like a little beauty in my life. I think part of the investing business that's tough, Howard, is that you can never kind of get away from it. The good news is you can do it anywhere and the bad news is that you do it anywhere. So you can never escape it. I realized a while ago that I just needed to have just some moments of peace, some moments of beauty around me. Otherwise, you know, the business really gets to you. This is one of the ways I've tried to find some balance.
And then finally, what's the one tool you would just give up last to run your business? Research or analytical or, you know, machine?
Oh, data. You mean like technical, like software or?
Yeah, just what's your baby that, like, if they took it away, it would throw you off?
Well, you know, Bloomberg is highly addictive. You know, I went a couple of years without Bloomberg, but once you're on that, I mean, it's just like a whole world that opens up. You know, there's a reason, you know, Mr. Bloomberg's a billionaire. You know, what does he have to, you have to pay 2 years in advance, something like, you know, $2,400, you know, a month. I mean, it's very expensive. But the ability to pull up anything, you know, I can find what the price of fish meal is in Peru. You know, I can find what Chinese interest rates are. You know, I can watch credit spreads in the Italian market, you know, and so you can answer almost any question through Bloomberg. But there's one important caveat there, though, Howard, is that, you know, more data does not equal better decisions.
Correctamundo. How have I done well not having a Bloomberg? So I just find the dilemma there.
No. I completely agree. I mean, but I guess I like Bloomberg because Bloomberg helps me answer the simple questions that I ask very quickly because I'm a visual person and I can pull up, you know, charts or I can download data. You know, I can eye a company's balance sheet very quickly. And so I like Bloomberg for that reason, because not because I drown in the data, but because there's a very specific question I want to answer, and Bloomberg gets me that answer fast.
Is it too small a market? Like, you know, I've always been fascinated, like Google, Twitter. Why the hell have they left that market alone? Just because Bloomberg has too big a lead? It just seems clunky.
Oh, you mean in terms of, say, why of the software companies aren't kind of...
reverse engineered the whole thing. I mean, isn't Google supposed to be able to do the exact same thing? What do you think it is? Is it not a big enough market? Or
it's a network effect, Howard. You would get that as a tech guy.
You're right.
You would get
that right. It's the network effect. It's the chat.
And what I mean by that, right, is, you know, is that in Bloomberg, any... Well, if it exists in the world, you can find it there. And so that's it's very much like the whole Amazon thing, right? Like why Bezos started in books, you know, it's the same idea with Bloomberg, and it is genius. It's a very powerful business model. But that's a great tool, you know, but I really would highlight that we don't drown in the data, but we can answer questions quickly with it.
No, you answered it perfectly. I'm glad to finally get you on Panic with Friends. I would say that our panic levels are not high. We're skeptics. We're a little bit like, what? Valuations? Come on. You know, snick, snick, snicker.
Yeah.
But we're not. You're not in a panic mode. Do you remember the first time you panicked?
Well, sure. I mean, here's what I discovered you know, in the course of investing for 20 years, though, Howard, it's like people panic because they should panic.
Good point. I always say, if you panic, just get it over with. Panic first. Well, don't wait.
What we tell people, though, is like our philosophy is panic early, beat the rush.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you panic when everybody else is panicking, then you get like the panic price. And that of course, is sloppy risk management. So that's one of the reasons why we end up, you know, maybe being early sometimes in some of our investment views and everything, Howard, right, is that we're trying to avoid, you know, some of the stampede, you know, prices. And so sometimes you sell things early and it, you know, goes up or whatever. But really the way we think about the world is through a risk management lens. We tell people we're risk managers first and foremost. You know, I mean, if you take the right risks, then you'll make the right returns. But, you know, returns don't come from the return fairy. Returns come from taking the right risk.
Wait a minute. The Fed is the return fairy. Bernanke and this new guy, whatever his name is, they're writing like now he's God all of a sudden. Oh, he's getting so much press.
Well, they are until they're not.
Yep. Well, there you go. Have it, everybody. Thank you, sir. I guess it's May. I guess I'll come out when the weather warms. And hopefully COVID will have calmed down. Stay safe out there. And people, you know where to find them, and just hit me up, everybody. But the trends and tail, that's good stuff that you put out. So we'll make sure everybody sees that. And have a great end of the year, and we'll talk to you soon, Lewis.
All right, you too, Howard. Thanks.
See ya.
Yes, sir.
Kanye!
I think the next time we have him on, we should do it on a boat in Florida.
Oh, if I had the time. And Netflix just came around and said, Howard, you're the man. The fun we could have talking about this stuff in location as he's fishing. The Fishing Musician was something that John Candy did back in Second City time, where he was just the Fishing Musician. And I just think golfing, fishing, life. Because like he said, it's hard. Investing's great because you can do it anywhere, and it's shit because you can do it anywhere. And I think this language that we're teaching or sharing and learning is meant to be done anywhere and everywhere. Meaning panic first, don't get caught up in the nonsense. Try and figure out what's on page 10 and then just, you know, keep that in the back of your mind, which is what we're doing here.
Great lessons.
In March, it was like, dude, it's all on the front page. Like, if the world's going to end, don't panic like everybody else. Now I would say everybody thinks tech stocks will... You know, now that they've survived COVID, they'll survive forever. And I'm trying to have people on to say, listen, this is not how it works. Could be a Saturday, could be gold, but it's not about what you're reading about today. So hopefully you enjoy that. For me, it's fun to talk to people like Lewis, because I could just go on forever and it's very geeky. So we will be back twice a week, Panic with Friends. And it's a smorgasbord of smart people talking about the markets, money, finance, people, software, technology, trends, panic, and in some cases, porn. Did we talk about porn today?
I think we forgot that today.
Oh, damn. Porn. So you can find me on Spotify or Google or on Apple, because they supposedly have a phone that has an app store and podcasts. So you can just search my name, Howard Lindzen, or StockTwits, which distributes it. And thanks, Knut, for putting this together.
My pleasure.
See everybody soon.